When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Heartbreaking article at the New York Times I came across today. Dave Lenhardt has a piece titled Big Profits in Caring for the Elderly. And it made me think about a friend of mine who, you know, this is the salt of the earth guy. I mean, you know, good, decent, honest, hardworking guy, spent his entire life busting his butt to put some money aside to get to that golden moment of retirement. And, you know, recently had a stroke and a heart attack and, you know, a whole bunch of setbacks that really have, you know, changed his life irreparably. But now that he's in assisted living care, all of the wealth that he accumulated over his lifetime is evaporating and quickly. You know, this is not an uncommon story. Look, all of us know somebody who this has happened to, and you know, sadly, parents and loved ones, and it's going to get worse. Understand, this scenario of dying broke. This is going to happen to a lot of us because we just don't have the policies in place. I don't think we have the interest, sadly. You talk to individuals and individuals are concerned about how are they going to take care of their parents? How are they going to take care of their loved ones? But as a matter of policy, this is bad. And the sad reality is we're a country that's getting older every day. I mean, we've all seen the statistics. You're going to have, you know, what is it? What's the number? Like 10,000 people every day are going to turn 65 until 2030. And they're expected to live into their 80s and 90s. And look, understand, this long-term care that we've completely neglected, they say is going to reach about $500 billion a year in costs. And look, we haven't prepared for any of this. And the sad reality, and you know, I think I was thinking today about my friend. And, you know, he's a guy who, like I said, he worked his entire life, busted his butt, saved as much as he could, lived very frugally, and, you know, thought he was going to be able to enjoy the golden years with his significant other. But an ailment, you know, something, you know, nobody expected, has made him, well, unable to care for himself in his own home. and his significant other, she can't care for him. She's got problems of her own. So now he's in one of these facilities. $14,000 a month, I understand. $14,000 a month. Understand, no matter how much he saved during his working life, $14,000 a month? You're looking at over $160,000 a year. No matter how much you have saved, that's not going to last very long. Especially when you consider the sad reality, they tack on additional fees. So when I saw this Dave Lenhart piece, it made me think that, you know, we're sorely ill-prepared. Especially with the fact that we spend so much on healthcare. According to his article, we spend about $13,000 per person in this country on healthcare, and we don't cover everyone. And everyone doesn't get equal treatment. But you stop and you think about $13,000 a year, a lot more than everyone else. Japan spends about $4,700 per person. Stop and think about the difference. And I know, but Rick, we get such better care. We get such better outcomes. Nonsense. Japan's life expectancy, 87.6 years. Us, at the bottom, 79.3 and falling. We spend more than every other industrialized country for healthcare. Everyone, without question, hands down, by a lot. The next closest, there's us at 13. The next closest at Germany at 7,400. We spend a lot more, and we don't get the improved outcomes. It used to be, understand, it used to be up until the 80s, the more you spent on healthcare, the better return you got. The more you invested in taking care of people, the longer they lived. The better policies you had, the better outcomes you got. And then something happened in 1980, something that took us away from this idea of investing in we the people, investing in infrastructure and, well, healthcare. Because remember, we used to have, I know it's hard to think about, we used to have community hospitals that were controlled by we the people, by the community. They weren't private for-profit interests, and they certainly weren't non-profit for-profit interests. They were for the good of we the people. Now we've got a healthcare industry. We don't have healthcare for and by we the people. We have an industry looking to make profit, lots of profit. And the caring for the elderly part is probably one of the more egregious, because these are the people who are the most vulnerable. And I look at my friend, who is now the most vulnerable he has been since he was a baby. And the system is screwing him over. The system is robbing him blind. He worked his entire life to build a little nest egg that he could retire on. And now, because of how our laws are, and because how we don't have regulatory oversight or policies to take care of folks in their most vulnerable state like this, he's going to die penniless. There will be nothing left. And congratulations, wealth class. You've figured out how to claw back the American dream. But what's frustrating in all of this is we know what the problems are. It's pretty simple. Healthcare is too expensive. We hear every politician talking about it. Healthcare is too expensive. I agree. Heard Ron DeSantis talk about it. Healthcare is too expensive. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to bring costs down? How are you going to bring competition back into an overly consolidated market? Because understand, this dying broke thing, only just beginning. The reality is we've got almost 1 million people living in some type of assisted living. And all of them are going to be broke. So the question becomes, you know, in an environment with escalating costs, what do you do? How do we deal with a situation where we're getting older? We need policy. But in a Congress that can't seem to get out of its own way, in a Congress that seems to be all about, well, show and bread and circus, how do we come to actual policy? Again, I go back to, we already spend more than everyone. So it's not a matter of resources per se. It's a matter of allocation, is it not? Now, understand, we spend less per capita, per GDP, than everyone else. We spend less of our GDP on health than everyone else does. But we still spend a lot of money. 13 grand for every man, woman, and child in this country we spend on healthcare. Where does it go? And it goes back to the profitization. You see the privatization of hospitals. I remember, you know, a decade or so ago, Dr. Bill Frist, senator from Tennessee, his family's worth $2 billion in healthcare facilities. They've bought up hospitals. When did healthcare become a for-profit industry? Now, I hear my right-wing friends say, well, you know, we need to bring competition back. And you go, okay, what does that look like? When my daughter fell and broke her arm, do you think I had the local hospitals on speed dial? Do you think I was calling each and every one of them going, who's got a deal today on broken arms? You got to buy one, get one. Got a coupon in the local, you know, coupon clipper. Can I get a deal? If I pay with cash, do I get 10% off? Do you think I was doing that? No, of course not. Where's the closest hospital? Where's the closest place I can get my daughter the care that she needs? Because that's what healthcare is. If I'm lying on the ground having a heart attack, I'm not speed dialing looking for who's got the best valve deal. I'm not going on Groupon or halfoff.com to find a place that's going to get me cheap care. I want the closest, best care possible, the best people possible. That's what we should want as a society. But we've been sold on a whole lot of bad ideas. And a lot of them emanated out of the Reagan era. I remember community hospitals. I was born in a community hospital. Funded by we the people. Where we understood that investment meant care for the community. When did we stop? And a big argument happened right around the Reagan era. When we stopped spending as much as the rest of the world per GDP on healthcare, and we decided something else. We were sold on the ideas that innovation was going to save us, and we spent a lot of money on innovation, that the free market would make things wonderful. And look, for some, understand, if you're one of the lucky folks at the top who can afford the best of the best of the best that we have to offer, yeah, you're going to do better. But if you're the working stiff like most of us are, you're going to not have the same outcomes. And I hear this all the time. Well, you know, we can't have socialized medicine. They'll ration care. Have you tried getting an appointment to a doctor lately? Seems like a bit of rationing. But worse yet, we're spending all of this money and we're not getting the return on investment. We're not getting the money back. And that is through better health, longer lives. We need regulation. This is where you need government action to control some of the prices. Because it's getting out of hand. It's getting crazy. And I think that my buddy who is in the most vulnerable moments of his life, and a system that only cares about, well, his bank account. How much can he put in? How much can we get out of him? And how long will it last? And the question is once that happens, once he's been drained of his resources, what then happens to him? Because interestingly enough, I'm looking at this 79.3 life expectancy number here in the U.S. as opposed to the 87.6 in Japan. And I gotta wonder, is 79.3 when the resources run out? I know that's a horrible thing to think. But at the end of the day, you have to kind of wonder. why do we have such a lower life expectancy than all of the other industrialized countries? France is over 85, Australia over 85, Sweden 85. Our friends to the north in Canada, 84.7, Germany, 83.4, the UK, 82.8, us, well, 79.3. And that's taking into account that we have a good percentage of people who can't afford the very best. And I know, but Rick, we lead different lifestyles. Not that much. That's not the response. We don't invest in preventative care. We don't encourage people to regularly go to the doctors because we put a paywall in front of things. We have bad policies. We have broken policies, especially for working people. We don't encourage people to go to the doctor, to be proactive. We don't. And I don't know that that's going to come because, well, we're still stuck on, they want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, the one piece of legislation that gives working people something of the ability to get health care. And what I find interesting is my Republican friends talk a lot about, well, of course, we're gonna make sure that pre-existing conditions are covered. Of course we are. And of course we want to, sure, cover those poor people. But you don't hear him talking about the profits. You don't hear him saying, you know what? We do need to rein in some of the greed. We do need to rein in some of the excessive, exorbitant CEO pays and the shareholder theft that goes on. No, you don't hear any of that. I'm saying we as a people, we as a country need to reclaim our commons. We need to reclaim our healthcare system. And we need to make it better. We're spending a lot of money. A lot. And we're not getting our return on investment. What we're getting is a well-heeled, well-fed, well-taken care of, wealth class, and people who are dying sooner than they should. That's where we are. And I fear one of those people is going to be my friend. The question is, when will we act? When will this be that moment where we go, this is ridiculous. We're spending more than everyone and we're getting worse outcomes. That's not how it's supposed to be. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Do you have a story like this? Someone in your life stuck in this scenario? And what policies should we be moving to ensure that people have access to care? That people have the ability, well, I don't know, to make it through their golden years okay. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You know, I remember when I was a kid, my mother worked in a nursing home for years. And it was a horrible, depressing place. It really was. I don't advocate for going back to that. In fact, I can still remember the smell of how bad things had been for people who had no money. Because the home that my mother worked in was for the indigent, the people who had burned through their resources or, much to their misfortune, had no resources. These were the down and out. These were the working people who didn't have a family to take care of them or the luxury of 14 grand a month. Policy-wise, we should be looking at how we ensure that we take care of the most vulnerable. And this is where I come back to where we need government action. Government action for me is about doing the things that we want to do individually but can't, that we have to do collectively as a society, and ensuring that seniors aren't left to be warehoused till they die or destitute and living in squalor is something we, in the wealthiest country in the history of civilization, something we can do. You know, I talked about yesterday about General Motors. They're buying $10 billion in stock back to shower their CEO class with more. Could that resource not be used better? Talked about the rail industry, who spent over an eight-year period, $176 billion in showering shareholders with dollars through stock buybacks to avoid paying taxes and doing all the things that we talked about. You know, we have the resource. We don't have the will. We have the resource. We don't have, well, the push from we the people, the demand. Because I think a lot of us think it's not going to happen to us. We're going to be okay. You know, I talk about, you know, I remember when my wife and I were about to have our first child. And someone asked me, you know, what are you hoping for? Because everyone, oh, you're hoping for a boy or a girl? And I said, I'm hoping for a girl, to be honest, because at least she'll give me a ride to the nursing home when I get old. If you have a son, maybe he'll give you cab fare, probably borrow it from you first. That's the mentality that I have, because sadly, it's the women who get saddled with the care. And I look at my family, my grandparents, they worked their entire lives. They saved a little bit. They had their pensions. They paid off their home. The wealth that they built, they wanted to pass something on to future generations. And fortunate for them, they were able to live out their lives in their homes. But it couldn't have been done without my aunt, who was there to ensure that they got to doctor appointments, was there to make sure that things got done, the grass got mowed, the light bill was paid, that things were running on time. There was someone there to help wash the clothes and the dishes and to help take care of things, help them clean and do all those things that once you get a little bit older, become a whole lot more difficult. And is what makes people end up not being able to live on their own. And I would argue longer. We don't have policies enough. There's a patchwork of a Band-Aid here and a Band-Aid there, and this community's got this and they've got this. There's a patchwork of something, but it's not sufficient. It's not prepared for what is coming. 10,000 people a day turning 65 every day from now till 2030. When the majority of people in this country are going to be over 65, there's a what's that saying? Houston, we have a problem. And again, our lawmakers are doing nothing to prepare us. And look, I look at my grandparents, and they were fortunate. They were able to live out their homes, their lives. They were able to go from being homeless when they got married to leading a solidly middle class, working class lifestyle. Bought homes, lived the majority of their life in the same home, raised their children, saved for retirement, lived in that retirement in dignity, and didn't have to be institutionalized, and were able to leave a little bit of something for their children. I think that's what most people want. They want to be able to do. But you stop and you think about that generation. That generation, my grandparents went from homeless to solidly middle working class. The wealth that they were able to create through their home, through their retirement savings, what they were hopefully to build some generational wealth and pass along to their children. Had they had to end up institutionalized in one of these places, it'd all be gone. Everything wiped out. And I think about my friend who spent his entire life building this little bit of money that he would retire and see the world and all this on. It's all going to be gone. And you go, well, that's what it's supposed to be there for, to help you in your... No, you're not supposed to be gouged in your most vulnerable moments. You're not supposed to be gouged at the moment when you're least able to stand up and defend yourself. That's not what we should be allowing. But here we are. So for me, I think policy-wise, we've got to start with the understanding that we do have a problem. And that problem needs to be addressed. And corporations, sorry, not the answer. Corporate America is not the answer to our problems. Not here. Because what have we found out? We find out that once a corporate interest, a for-profit interest, buys up one of these nursing homes, and over the last couple of decades, there has been a slew of county nursing homes being bought up by corporations. Everyone in their community knows that there was a fight to keep the county home in county hands, but no, we're so starved for tax dollars, we got to sell off the last assets that the county has. And it's going to be the county home. It's going to be granny. And what's the first thing that happens? Well, they go in, they break the union, they cut the wages, they cut the staff, they do all the things that corporations do to turn a profit. They squeeze the quarter till the eagle screams. And what does that mean? Well, it means worse outcomes for patients and residents, clearly, but also for workers in the community. But it means good profit, really good profit, for the hedge funds or the corporate titans who have taken over these industries. So the question, again, I come back to, when will we say no more? When will we get active in the idea that, you know what, there's something wrong here? We shouldn't be allowing this. Because we need the policy. Because, like it or not, every one of us are going to get old. Every one of us are going to find our days where we're not able to care for ourselves as we once did. Every one of us are going to need help. And when that help's not there, or that help that we need comes with a profit motive, I gotta wonder. And it's angering and frustrating and all of the above, absolutely. But for me, the question comes back to, when do we say enough? When do we make elected leaders accountable? When do we say we need, I know, heaven forbid, here it comes, we need government. We need government that's proactive. We need government that cares about the people. Now, I understand what corporations are about. It's not about providing health care. It's not about providing, you know, elder care. It's not about providing widgets. It's about profit. When you put the profit motive in the health motive without it being outcome driven, you kind of have a problem. Because it then just becomes about $12 to check your blood pressure, $50 for an injection. It becomes about nickeling and diming you to death. Why is our healthcare system so expensive? You can say it. Corporations have robbed us blind and are robbing us blind. We need to be reclaiming these systems. But I'll tell you, I think about my friend Jake, this was a guy who worked his behind off. And to see him in this most vulnerable state, being taken advantage of by a system that, well, there's no alternative. There's no one who can care for him. There's something wrong. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. For those watching on the TV show, we're going to be wrapping up for today. For those on our radio affiliates, we're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with more. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So recently we had Ken Mash, the president of ABSCUF, on the program to talk about the ongoing negotiations with the union that represents some 5,000 faculty and coaches on 14 campuses across the Pennsylvania state system and the state system of higher education here in the state. Their contract expired on, I think it was June 30th of this year, and the negotiations have been going on for, probably a year before that. So this is kind of getting into really long territory and something that, you'd think shouldn't be all that difficult. But it appears that things aren't going as easily as one would hope. And that's why I've asked John Gump to come talk with us. John is ABSCUF's coach executive leader and one of the folks negotiating this contract. John, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
So as I understand, the contract expired on the 30th of June. You guys have been in long-term negotiations, probably half a year before that, right?
Yeah, we probably sat down for the first time in January of this year, so about 6 months or so before the expiration of the contracts.
Now, does this take this long usually? I mean, do you get this far beyond the contract, or is this more contentious? I guess not more than the last time, because you were on strike the last time. But you finding it more or less now?
Well, faculty went on strike the last time. Coaches did not. This is my third time being part of the negotiations team for coaches' contract, and the first two, neither one were done by the expiration of the previous. In fact, I believe the first one that we did may have been 18 months after the expiration. It's not unusual for it to push past the expiration deadline of the contract. So that part of it isn't terribly worrisome. I still think we're on a timeline that's pretty typical.
Okay, good. And issues about typical, I understand, again, one of the things unions fight for are job security. I think that's one of the big sticking points for coaches in the state system, that a little security is kind of important.
Yes, we're fighting in these negotiations, as we have in the previous ones, to try to improve the job security for our membership, particularly as it relates to things like non-renewals that can't be grieved. We have a fairly long, not fairly long, it's actually very long probationary period. It takes 5 years for a coach to get to the point where they're eligible for a rollover contract, which provides some additional security. But 5 years is a very long time to be in a probationary period. It seems like you should have a pretty good idea that a coach is doing a good job long before they have to get through 5 years.
Right.
And then the last piece is we have an evaluation process in the state system for coaches, but that evaluation process is not tied to the renewal of contracts. And so it is possible for a coach to get years, in fact, of evaluations that are at expectations or above expectations, and then still have their contract non-renewed, which just it's counterintuitive. I mean, it's not logical. I mean, if a coach is doing a good job, they should be able to stay in that job.
Yeah, but what do you say, John, to the person who goes, look, your coaches are fired all the time. We see it in the newspaper all the time, John. The coach from, the NFL coaches get fired, all the time. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is nobody's walking away from a state system school with a $76 million severance package.
There is that.
We're a little different world, right? The role of coaches in the state system and the role of coaches in the NFL or the role of coaches at the highest levels of Division I are really, really different, right? Coaches in our system, we're student-focused. Our main focus is on our student athletes having an outstanding experience as students, but also as athletes, because the reality is it's a very, very small number of athletes in the state system that are going to go on to earn a living, right, continuing to play their sport after college. Right. So when they finish their eligibility and when they graduate from our institutions, they need to be ready for the professional part of their life that does not involve athletics anymore. So the focus of what coaches in the state system do is entirely different. So, you know, judging our coaches on the same kind of scale that people read about coaches being judged at, you know, at Texas A&M or in the NFL, those two things just they just don't line up.
Because, you know, you look, you don't want to just be, you know, walk in one day and there's the door, you're fired for no reason. And what we're not talking about is, you know, because there's this frame out there, I'm sure you've heard it, that you it's impossible to fire a union member. And I know people are going, well, it shouldn't be impossible to fire coaches. It's not that it's impossible to fire somebody. You can be fired, but you have to be, it has to be for a reason, a good reason, with due process. I think that's the minimum we should be asking for.
Correct. And one of the things that we're asking for is language that right now, the language in our contract says that the decision to not renew a contract shall not be reviewable in any manner through the grievance and arbitration process. We want language that allows a coach in the event of being non-renewed to have grievance rights if they feel that that decision was arbitrary and capricious. The state system assures us that they have no desire, no intention of being arbitrary and capricious. Right. But they also have no intention of putting that language in the contract to prevent them from doing it.
So it's basically, trust me.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I trust very few people, John.
Well, and our experience has shown us that it has happened to coaches. Right? Coaches have gotten an evaluation at the end of their year and been told they're above expectations, and then gotten an evaluation at the end of the next season, told they're at expectations. And then 3 months later, at the anniversary date of their contract, they're told, oh, by the way, we're not renewing your contract.
There's the door.
You know, and again, if there are issues, coaches want to know through the evaluation process. They want to be given an opportunity to improve that performance if there is an issue. But to just come out of left field and, you know, and tell a coach, everything's fine, you're doing what we need you to do, your performance is meeting our expectations, and then all of a sudden, but by the way, we're not renewing your contracts.
I got a brother-in-law that needs a job.
Yeah. It would be similar to a coach, you know, telling a player, you know, all season long, you know, I'm happy with your performance. You're doing exactly what the team needs you to do. Just keep doing what you're doing, you know, and then at the end of the season meeting, oh, by the way, I'm cutting you and not bringing you back next year. That would be wrong. And it's wrong for a coach to do it to a student athlete, and it's certainly wrong for management to do it to a coach.
So what's the rationale behind the state system not wanting to at least put some language in this and say, you know, we're going to fire people. It's going to be for a reason. It's not going to be willy nilly. What's wrong with putting something down that gives coaches a little bit of ability to maybe to fight back? What's wrong with that? And what's the rationale for not?
You know, you're kind of asking me to climb inside the head.
Okay. Because they've got to tell you, go, look, you know, this is a non-starter with us. Tough luck. We're not doing it. Or is that how it is?
Yeah. Basically, okay. The rationale is we're not interested in changing the language. We're happy with the language as it is.
And where does this lead us then? I mean, ultimately, because I think you're right. And I remembered after you said it, the faculty went on strike. The coaches did not the last time. Coaches don't want to be in this. I'm sure none of the coaches want to be in this situation. Nobody wants to be making this, you know, an issue. But it seems to be an issue. So where does this go if the state system says, tough, we're not moving?
Well, I mean, we're a long way away from having to make any kind of decisions like that. There's still a lot of time to discuss. And, you know, we're hopeful that we can, you know, continue to make some progress in this area. You know, we've made progress on the actual evaluation instrument. We've worked hard at the table on that, both sides. And it was a productive give and take. It was, you know, productive discussions, and we reached we made some progress significantly in that area. Our frustration at the end of that, though, Rick, is that they're not willing to now take that progress on the process of evaluations and make it really mean something by saying, if a coach gets a good evaluation, we'll renew their contract.
Yeah, it sounds like they want these evaluations and all this stuff for the negatives, but the positive side of it, meaning job security, not interested in. And this is one of the things, again, I want to emphasize this, because job security is one of the things that unions fight for. It's not that a union member cannot be fired. They can. If you don't do the job, if there's something there that you did wrong, absolutely you can be fired. But there's got to be a process. And I think that's, if I'm getting this right, I think that's all you're really asking for, is that due process and ending an at-will situation.
Right. The biggest things we want are the evaluation to mean something, so that if there are performance issues, the coach is given an opportunity to address those. I mean, that's what coaches do. Right, you spend all of your time evaluating where your team is. You evaluate your tactics. You evaluate your recruit. You evaluate all aspects of your program and try to determine where you can do better. So coaches don't have a problem with an evaluation. It's what we do all the time. What we have a problem with is an evaluation process that doesn't mean anything. You know, and the other piece is, there should be an avenue, if there is some disagreement, for a coach to have recourse if they're not renewed.
Yeah, I mean, if you get a bad evaluation, you want to know why, and you want to be able to defend yourself. I think that makes common sense. It is common sense, right?
Well, and again, there's a frustrating piece is, you can grieve the evaluation. Right, but they won't extend that arbitrary and capricious language that exists in the evaluation process to the renewal process.
So let me get this straight. You can grieve the evaluation, but they're going to use the evaluation not to renew your contract, which you cannot then, you can't grieve the non-renewal. So then,
correct.
I'm missing the point of the whole system then.
Well, and again, because it flies in the face of common sense and logic. Right, that you wouldn't use the evaluation to determine whether or not you renew a contract. I mean, it just makes no sense. And for whatever reason, and again, they haven't been able to articulate it at the table. And one of the reasons I think they haven't been able to articulate it is because, again, and from my perspective, there's no way to defend it. Right? There's no way to defend wanting to reserve the right to make arbitrary and capricious decisions. And so rather than be able to provide any sort of rationale or any sort of reason, it's just, well, we're not interested. We're done talking about that. We're happy with the way things are.
So how can we move them? How can we help? How can folks help move them in a direction to go, hey, you know, maybe you should talk. Maybe you should rethink that.
If you're a fan of athletics in the state system and you're a spectator, reach out to, you know, university administration, whether it's the president or the vice president who oversees athletics, and just share that. You know, you're concerned about a lack of respect being shown to coaches in the system. We have buttons that coaches, faculty are wearing on our campuses that I'm sure APSCUF will be happy to make available to anyone who wants to wear a Respect Our Coaches button while sitting in the stands or attending any of our sporting events. Reaching out and sharing thoughts on, because coaches make such a positive impact in the life of student athletes.
I agree. Look, some of the most important people in my life have been, you know, coaches from the past. You know, my high school football coach was probably the most influential person that I've ever met. He kept me on the straight and narrow, and the reason I graduated from high school.
Yeah, and so all that we're asking is that the role that coaches play and the value that we bring to our campuses and the important role that we play in the lives of our student athletes and their development during their time on our campuses, that be reflected with a level of respect that we don't always see from the state system.
Well, I hope, I wish you guys the best as you continue this negotiations and move down the road. I can't believe it's taken this long. It's one of those things where you just go, seriously, it shouldn't take this long to get this done, but I wish you guys the best. I know you've got another meeting coming up sometime in January. I'd love to hear from you then, when this comes around, and anything we can do to help, John, I appreciate the time.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
Good stuff. John Gump, he is the coach executive leader there with AppScuff. Again, you want to check out the website, appscuff.org is the site if you want to take a look at what's going on there and maybe get some of those buttons. I think I would like one, to be honest. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 2008. That was the day UE Local 1110 members at Republic Windows in Chicago began a five-day occupation to protest the imminent closure of their plant. A month earlier, Republic workers witnessed management moving machinery out of the factory. They began monitoring where the machinery was going and soon learned it was headed for a new non-union plant in Iowa. They planned a possible plant occupation. By December 2nd, management announced the plant was closing in just 3 days. Republic Windows owner Richard Gelman blamed Bank of America for refusing to extend credit just as the federal government had bailed out the banks in a $700 billion deal. Workers learned they would receive no severance or vacation pay despite WARN Act mandates. The next day, they rallied out in front of Bank of America, chanting, "You got bailed out, we got sold out." Workers were determined to occupy the plant that Friday when they went to pick up their last paychecks. Police refused to remove the sit-downers, and the occupation quickly made national news. Local labor leaders and trade unionists, activists, and politicians all visited strikers and lent their support. Journalist Carrie Leiterson recounts the events in her book, Revolt on Goose Island, noting the donations of food, blankets, pillows, sleeping bags, and other necessities that poured into the factory. Protests of Bank of America spread across the country. By the following Wednesday, workers learned that though they could not keep their plant open, they would at least win severance and vacation pay. In 2012, some of those workers reopened that plant under the name New Era Windows as a worker-run cooperative. They specialize in energy-efficient vinyl windows. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And just, you know, follow up on the John Gump segment. You know, the reality is, and this is the part that just is kind of infuriating in the day we're in. Because I thought, you know, at some point in my life, the idea of having some claim to your employment, some bit of security, seemed to be a norm. Growing up, you know, that idea that you only got fired if you did something wrong. You know, we had fought, my grandparents' generation fought back against nepotism and favoritism and all of that stuff, only to find that it's now back. And patronage coming back in big ways. And look, you got a former president who's talking about loyalty to me and me alone. This is where I think, again, John and AppScuff have got a point. Coaches should have some bit of security, but not, you know, look, they're not asking for, I know the view, and I've heard this from people for years. You can't, it's impossible to fire a union member. It's not true. I've seen lots of people fired over the years. I've just never seen someone fired for no reason. For you to get fired from a job, you had to do something wrong. And in a country that believes in due process, doesn't it seem like common sense that you'd go, yeah, there's got to be some rationale. Okay, you had a losing record. Your team sucked. You did a lot of bad things. There's a reason. But to say, you know, just whatever, I just don't like you, whatever that rationale is, my son-in-law needs a job, I don't know. It seems weird. It seems interesting to me. And I know sports is a whole different game, and everyone's like, no, you should be able to fire the coach for any reason whatsoever. No, not at this level. And like I mentioned to John a moment ago, my high school coach was somebody that a lot of the reason that I'm where I am today, I probably would not have finished high school had it not been for that guy. Because I was not on a good path. My mother had passed. I lived with my grandparents, and they were, you know, they didn't know how to deal with a 13-year-old, you know, derelict like I was, in their advanced age, and they were just ready for retirement. It was that guy who said, "No, you're gonna be something. You're gonna be great." He saw something in me that I didn't see in myself, and pushed. Wasn't always the nicest guy to me, not by any stretch, but gave me a reason to continue and a reason to show up every day, even if it wasn't for the academic side of it. And look, I was not a great student. You can ask anybody who knew me. No, was not a priority. That wasn't until I got to college. But coaches mean more than just wins and losses, especially at the level that they're talking about. So I'm hopeful that the state system will come around to its senses and give these coaches the respect and the dignity that they earn every day. Here's a good story, an interesting story coming out of New York. You may remember New York set a minimum wage in the city of saying, you know, I think it's, what is it? It goes up to $20 an hour in 2025. I think it's like almost $18 an hour now. Well, you got all of these companies like DoorDash and Uber and Grubhub and, you know, all of these app companies who have made their millions and, well, billions off of the backs of low wage work, off of the backs of people who are out there hustling just to try and make a couple extra bucks to make it to the end of the week. And what New York has gone and done is they have put a legislation in place that if you work for somebody for a living, you got to pay at least this amount of minimum wage. Well, last week, a state appeals court judge, they rejected these companies' claims that this was onerous and wanted it overturned. The rule will go into effect. Right now, it had been temporarily delayed because didn't know what the decision was going to be. Well, now this is going to have to go into place, and it's going to be interesting to see whether these groups can survive in the world of not having to cheat workers out of wages. Because what I found interesting, in a place where, I don't know about you, but I've been to New York City, I don't know how you live on $11 an hour, but that's what these app drivers are right about what they're making, somewhere around about $11 an hour. That's after they get all their tips, and that's after they get, you know, they pay their expenses and all of that. But about $11 an hour in a city where the minimum wage is currently, I guess, $15, it's supposed to go up to 17 something, and then I guess 20. Is it 2025 it goes up to $20? But this is one of these moments where you go, what happens? If they can no longer exploit low-wage work, how are they going to profit? Because there's a point at which, you know, that Big Mac, and I know everyone's talking about the $16 Big Mac meal or whatever it was out of, was it Idaho or Wyoming? How many people are going to be able to pay the delivery fees? And this, shouldn't we be going, you know, we should have jobs that are more than just serving rich people or richer than poor people? Shouldn't we have jobs that, you know, I don't know, are better for society? Now, the industry is losing their minds. The industry is saying, you know, well, it could eliminate jobs, could be bad things. You know, there are going to be operational changes. And I hope so. I hope those operational changes come in the form of paying workers a wage that they can live on. Now, I've had numerous conversations with people who go, well, you know, but Rick, this is, you know, this is how, you know, people who are willing to go out and hustle, this is how they make more money. And I go, how? Off of the benevolence of others? Okay, so you make a couple of bucks. But if it's pulling everything else down and it's creating an environment where we're exploiting people, what good is that? And I go back to, what good is an economy if it doesn't lift conditions for people, if it doesn't make lives better? These are people who work incredibly hard. And I love the argument that, well, you know, if you do this, that just means people are going to have to do more. They're going to have to do more. They're going to have to go faster. They're going to have to drive faster. They're going to have to take more deliveries. And you go, wait a second. that's what you're already pushing them to do. So while the Grubhub folks are disappointed, according to the article, they are evaluating their next steps, which could mean that they leave New York, which could mean that there's no more of that. And maybe we go back to having a scenario where, you know, the local pizza shop has a delivery guy again. And in the time when that guy's not delivering, he's making pizzas or he's doing other things where he actually kind of does have a job. I got to tell you, it's interesting times we live in, that this is how the wildly wealthy are lining their pockets at the expense of these folks who are just trying to put food on the table. That's really what bothers me. And I know we can do better. I know we can. But good on the appeals court, good on the folks in New York. I hope that at some point the rest of us wake up to a little bit of sanity and the rest of us wake up to a little bit of, you know, maybe belief in hard work. But I want to hear your thoughts. If you miss any portion of the program, download the podcast. Wherever you get your podcast, you'll find ours. As always, if something I said got on your nerves, under your skin, made you think, I want to know about it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The number one selling product of its kind with over 20 years of research and innovation. Botox Cosmetic, onabotulinum toxin A, is a prescription medicine used to temporarily make moderate to severe frown lines, crow's feet, and forehead lines look better in adults.
Effects of Botox Cosmetic may spread hours to weeks after injection, causing serious symptoms. Alert your doctor right away as difficulty swallowing, speaking, breathing, eye problems, or muscle weakness may be a sign of a life-threatening condition. Patients with these conditions before injection are at highest risk. Don't receive Botox Cosmetic if you have a skin infection. Side effects may include allergic reactions, injection site pain, headache, eyebrow and eyelid drooping, and eyelid swelling. Allergic reactions can include rash, welts, asthma symptoms, and dizziness. Tell your doctor about medical history, muscle or nerve conditions including ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, myasthenia gravis, or Lambert-Eaton syndrome and medications, including botulinum toxins, as these may increase the risk of serious side effects. For full safety information, visit BotoxCosmetic.com or call 877-351-0300.
See for yourself at BotoxCosmetic.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.